How do opponents of Israel's actions in Gaza address criticisms by the Israel supporters that they are enabling Hamas terrorism? How can individuals condemn actions by settlers in Canada against indigenous people and support actions by settlers in Israel against Palestinians? Is the U.S. not only allowing the Israeli genocide to happen, but actually calling the shots? How is the United States allowing Israel, Iran, the United Kingdom, and even Canada to do their dirty work for them? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we take another look at illegal actions in the Middle East and try to assess ways to resolve the situation justly and peacefully in a seemingly complex and challenging world. In our first half hour, we speak with Michael Link, a Canadian professor of law and former special rapporteur on human rights in the occupied Palestine territories, about some of the pressing difficulties in arriving at a satisfactory legal solution. And in our second half hour, we hear from Michelle Chosudovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization and a Global Research Editor about how the focus of much of the peace movement is too much on Israel and not enough on the architects of Israel's actions located in Washington, D.C. On this week's program, the crimes of Israel and their puppet master, the U.S., conversations with Professor Michael Link and Professor Michelle Chosudovsky. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 25th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The European settlers on this land got the resources on the land on which they are located via force, broken treaties, and unfair promises with the indigenous people who lived here first and delivered onto them crimes of colonialism and genocide. We should seek to restore a respectful partnership by reconciliation for past wrongs and by reparations going into the future. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. In 1997, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen admitted, "We have the technology to control the weather, including earthquakes and volcanoes." The U.S. government has placed gag orders on employees of the National Weather Service. In October of 2012, after Hurricane Sandy weakened to a tropical storm, microwave imagery shows a thick red beam immediately followed by Sandy, growing into a Category 1 hurricane and taking an unexplained, quote, left turn, unquote, into New Jersey. The push towards alternative energy demands more lithium, and according to the U.S. Geological Survey, the United States has over 6 million tons of identified lithium resources. That comes from the article, "How to Steer Hurricanes, Flood Homes, and Steal Lithium: West North's Tragic Aftermath," by Greg Rees and Professor Michelle Chosudovsky, posted October 24th with additional files from the Rees Report. Eradication of an entire society is not just the objective of Netanyahu. Do not get that wrong. Netanyahu is a mere useful and willing player in this atrocious endeavor. The overall and long-term goal of Zionist Israel is much larger, way beyond Palestine. It is about control of most of the Middle East and most of the region's energy, oil, and gas. They are striving for a greater Israel that subjugates the world as their Bible, the Torah, tells them, the chosen people. Even one of the world's most important shipping routes, the Zionists want to dominate, the Red Sea, by doing whatever they can to make the Egypt-Arab-owned Suez Canal obsolete, dangerous, and unusable by first allowing the Yemeni Houthi insurgency attacking Israeli, British, and U.S. cargo vessels, thus dissuading other European vessels from using it, and second, by building an alternative, the Ben-Gurion Canal, through Israel into the Gulf of Aqaba to the Red Sea. See map below. That comes from the article, The Truth About Israel's War on Gaza, Palestine, Lebanon, the Middle East, Peter Koenig, by Peter Koenig, posted October 24th. Little has changed since 2005, except that these crimes have increased along with the propaganda denying them, together with vastly increased censorship. Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Russia via Ukraine, etc. All targets of U.S. bombs, just like Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, etc. Now, the U.S. has brought the world to the brink of nuclear war, and the voting public is all worked up over choosing between candidates supporting genocide and the massively expanded Israel attack on neighboring countries. It is a frightening spectacle of moral indifference and stupidity as we await the Israel-U.S. bombing of Iran and Iran's response. Yet I ask myself and I ask you, is there a connection between the voting public's support for these war criminals and attention deficit disorder, amnesia, and dementia? That comes from the article, quote, soul suicide, unquote, in the ballot box, as Palestinians are butchered, Edward Curtin, by Edward Curtin, posted October 24th, originally published on the author's blog site Behind the Curtain. Not just cars and trucks, but lawn equipment, stoves, water heaters, you name it. They want it to run on electricity instead of coal, oil, or gas. Against this backdrop, the U.S. government is looking inward for more sources of lithium. That's where North Carolina enters the scene. The federal government is pressuring a small town in North Carolina to allow an old lithium mine to be reopened, despite local backlash against the corporation seeking a permit. In mid-September, just 2 weeks before Hurricane Helene blasted this area of North Carolina, the U.S. Department of Defense awarded Albemarle Corporation a $90 million grant to restart mining operations in Cleveland County. That comes from the article, Why is the U.S. Department of Defense giving $90 million to a private corporation to reopen an old lithium mine in western North Carolina? By Leo Holman, posted October 24th, originally published on Leo's newsletter. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Michael Link is Emeritus Professor in the Faculty of Law
in Western University in London, Ontario. In March 2016, the United Nations Human Rights Council appointed Professor Link as the seventh special rapporteur for the human rights situation in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. He came to Winnipeg last week to give a presentation to a crowd of roughly 120 people on the human rights situation in Israel-Palestine currently and measures that could be taken to resolve the conflict now besieging the region. Michael Link, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Michael, for having me.
Before you your event, you had gone to the Canadian Human Rights Museum. Could I maybe just get your impression of the Israel-Palestine situation there?
I mean, the museum is a is an institution that Winnipeg is, I'm sure, very proud of. It's a splendid building, eye-taking and in its design, and you couldn't think of a more important or critical topic to have a museum for than to focus on human rights and the many human wrongs that humans have done to each other. I had a chance, this is the second time I think I've been to the museum. I've had a chance to go through it thoroughly on both occasions. I do notice that there is a minimal reference to the question of Israel and Palestine in the museum. I have talked to museum officials, and I know they're thinking deeply about how to wind up addressing this absence. It's a telling absence, particularly in this moment where we have such a horrible, devastating wars actually ongoing in the Middle East. People crave understanding. They crave putting the context of these kinds of wars into a human rights context that they can understand for themselves. And let's hope that the museum can wind up rising to the moment to make a presentation on what are the human rights issues at hand in Israel and Palestine that will make us understand this in the broader context of international human rights law and a human rights framework.
Imagine for a minute I'm an Israeli defender, and I would argue that yes, it is tragic what has happened to Palestinians, but the war currently underway is a response to a terrorist attack on October 7th. Do you agree that the attack on October 7th was a crime, or do you say it is actually defensible?
No, I think that even with the best of causes, liberation movements can break international law in how they choose to conduct their defense of their own people, how they resist an unjust situation. And so while international law, I think, is on the side of those who want to see a just solution to Israel and Palestine and to recognize the subjugation by Israel and the Palestinians, the specific attacks on October 7th were, and I think most estimations, to be war crimes. There's a very clear distinction to be made in international law between civilians and combatants, and the Palestinian armed groups crossed that line in the attacks they made on the civilians who were at the music festival and the civilians who were living in their communities in Israel, and in taking civilian hostages back into Gaza. Having said that, history in the Middle East did not start on October 7th. There is a long history with respect to Palestinian dispossession from their indigenous lands, hundreds of UN resolutions that have gone ignored and unheeded by Israel with respect to the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and their homeland, resolutions which said that it's a violation of international law to annex occupied territory. It's a violation of international law to create civilian settlements on occupied territory, that all of the protections of the Geneva Convention and international humanitarian law wind up applying. All of those resolutions and more have been defied by Israel, putting it in, I guess, a very rare outlier category of being in serial defiance of the Charter of the United Nations and of international law. So we have to understand October 7th as an event in itself. Mm-hmm. We also have to understand October 7th as a cumulation of a long series of events where severe injustice has been met in a way that did cross the bright red line. But I also must say that what happened after October 7th, are war crimes, crimes against humanity, and the International Court of Justice has said a plausible genocide is ongoing. The fact that crimes may have been committed against you does not justify, under international law, you committing war crimes or other violations of international law in response, in how you respond to those attacks.
What do you say to the Israeli defenders' argument that while Israel doesn't support killing civilians, Hamas actually uses Palestinians as human shields, tunnels under mosques and hospitals and so forth, based on what you know from your own travels and you know, anything that's come out since. Is there any truth to the human shields claims? And if so, does it potentially legally restrict Israel from taking action in defense of its own population pretty much forever?
Very good question, Michael. Human shields are illegal under international law. An army cannot use civilians to protect soldiers or combatants from attacks from the other side. And there was an article recently in The Guardian that's reporting on other recent reports about how Israel has been using Palestinians in Gaza as human shields during the conduct of their operations in homes or in buildings or in going across open areas in Gaza. In terms of Hamas, the main claim made against Hamas with respect to human shields is the creation of tunnels that were underneath one of the main hospitals, Al-Aqsa Hospital in Gaza. Israel eventually captured that particular hospital. And after making these claims that underneath the hospital was a command center in one of the tunnels, and the revelation of the evidence shown by Israel really proved nothing of the sort, that there may have been there were weapons there in this tunnel underneath the hospital, but nothing that would approach a command center or justification under law to be able to attack the hospital based on this now seemingly evidence-free claim with regards to this. Even if one side is firing weapons from within a civilian area, that does not give the other side the right to therefore treat the entire area as a combat zone when it knows that there are civilians or civilian institutions in that particular area. And the United Nations has made that statement and that caution to Israel on a number of occasions during the last 12 months and how it conducts its war. We got to remember that, you know, of the 42 or 43,000 Palestinians now officially confirmed dead, and there may well be thousands more who are dead and whose remains have not been recovered in the rubble created by the war. The vast majority of those are civilians. At a minimum, you know, around 13,000 children have been killed. Around 8,000 women have been killed. Many unarmed and uninvolved men have been killed as well during the course of this. The civilian toll is extraordinary. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said as early as November 2023, far too many Palestinian civilians have been killed. And he repeated that for the next couple of months until became so obvious that he was repeating this as a trope, yet not doing anything effective to try to bring the war to an end, to effect a ceasefire. So I think there will be plenty of issues of accountability, both against Hamas leadership, but also against the Israeli military and political leadership at the end, because of the high civilian toll, both on October 7th and what's occurred since in Gaza after October 7th.
You mentioned in your October 19th presentation at the University of Manitoba that the peace negotiations over Israel-Palestine for more than 30 years have been grounded more in the realpolitik as opposed to international law. Realpolitik, as I understand it, was about taking, a shortcut or something, as opposed to the long and arduous task of going through international law and principles. Has there been a development since the early 1990s which changed the landscape or the equation in any way? Or do you understand the reasons why going the realpolitik route 3 decades ago seemed at first to have merit? And I mean, I should also mention that during that process, the Israelis seemed to increase the settlements. They weren't really interested in peace. They were just interested in their long-term goal. But what's your understanding of the route that the world community took there? Yeah.
Sure. The Oslo process refers to the agreements that were signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the State of Israel in 1993 with the famous handshake on the White House lawn between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat. And at the heart of it is these declaration of principles that form the foundation of the Oslo process. They were built in the absence of international law. International law was very clear even before the Oslo process that an occupying power has no claim to even a square centimeter of occupied territory. International law was clear right from the 1980s that Israel violated international law by annexing unilaterally the occupied East Jerusalem and by creating civilian settlements in occupied territory. Those were never defined in the Oslo process. And what the Oslo process then set in motion was, if you like, this realpolitik approach that you mentioned, where basically might makes right, that Israel, with its far superior military, political, and diplomatic power vis-a-vis the Palestinians, would be able to create a final agreement with the Palestinians in the absence or the exclusion of international law, and allow, you know, a Palestinian statelet to emerge, a Bantustan, that would have the right to issue its own stamps, it would have its own flag, it would have its own seat at the United Nations, but it wouldn't have any definition of what a modern state would look like as political science would wind up teaching us. And that is why I think over all the various peace initiatives that were launched within the Oslo framework over the past three decades, particularly the Camp David process in 2000, the Annapolis process, the John Kerry process in 2013, 2014, and the Trump plan in 2020, all failed and were all bound to fail because they ignored and excluded what international law requires. So where I think we might be at now is perhaps a paradigm shift. We have a decision that was issued in July of 2024, an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice, which I think is well grounded, well anchored in international law, and says that any peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis has to be anchored in these fundamental legal principles, which is Israel returns to its June 4th, 1967 boundaries. The occupation completely ends. All of the settlements and all of the 740,000 settlers wind up returning back to Israel, and the Palestinians can have a free state in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. And then that decision, that advisory opinion in July, was endorsed by an overwhelming majority of the UN General Assembly in a vote in mid-September of 2024. I think 124 nations in favor, only 14 against. So that, to me, as an international lawyer, sets the framework for returning to international law. And then the question becomes, and I have to leave this open, is, is that the path to be able to go forward? Will that bring us to a final resolution? You know, one may argue that the Israeli occupation, with over 12% of the Israeli Jewish population living in illegal settlements in occupied territory, 740,000 settlers, is that, if we already passed the last off ramp to get a just peace based on a two-state solution or not? Time will tell. The UN Security Council General Assembly resolution in September gave Israel 12 months to end the occupation completely. And that diplomatic alarm clock will ring next September. I highly doubt that Israel will comply with the resolution. I highly doubt that the United States will object to Israel's non-compliance with the resolution. And then I think we'll be faced with an extremely sharp diplomatic crisis for the world, and particularly for the United Nations, as to what to do in the face of Israel's abject defiance of international opinion and international law and UN resolutions.
Just like to ask you one more question. In Canada, I've noticed that there are plenty of people in the Israeli Zionist camp, but much like the Canadian Museum of Human Rights and the progressive Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, they acknowledge the settlers of Canada have done wrong against the Indigenous peoples, acknowledging colonialism and genocide and so forth, and yet they don't seem to acknowledge similar settler Indigenous crimes against the Palestinians. They say it's just totally different. What has been your experience in dialogues with the Israel defenders of bringing up this parallel and in explaining the legal and moral obscenity of the ongoing situation?
I think most defenders of Israel have avoided talking about international law. They've avoided about talking about UN resolutions because they are so markedly against their position. They have to argue from, I guess, a defense of what is now becoming increasingly indefensible in the eyes of so many people across the globe, that you can think in the 21st century, you can subjugate an entire people living on their indigenous land and create what the International Court of Justice has said is a plausible genocide in order to be able to defend your particular privileges. We have astonishingly detailed reports over the last 5 years coming from Human Rights Watch, from Amnesty International, the two leading international human rights organizations, from Palestinian organizations such as Al-Haq or the Palestine Human Rights Center, and from Israeli human rights groups such as Yashdin, Breaking the Silence, and B'Tselem, which say this is apartheid, that Israel has created a state which privileges Jewish rights, Jewish Israeli rights, over Palestinian Arab rights, both within the state of Israel and obviously in the occupied territories. And that's no foundation to be able to bring peace or prosperity for any length of time for either peoples. You know, the best hope for the future is going to be a compassionate peace based on equal rights for all, which is at the very heart of the universalist foundation of our human rights framework in international and domestic law, of a future that Palestinians and Israelis can buy into, that treats them both as equals to each other, whether it be a two-state solution or a one-state democratic solution. But it has to be anchored in international law. It has to be anchored in the rule of law. And it has to be anchored in this framework that everybody has the same rights as everybody else, regardless of their ethnicity or their religion. At the end of the day, one of the things I learned from long experience with this question, particularly while I was special rapporteur, as this is not, at the very end of the day, a struggle between over ethnicity between Jews and Arabs, and it's not ultimately a struggle over religion, even though it may have the appearance in both cases of that. It really is a struggle over rights, and that's why you see Israeli Jews and Jews around the world, not a majority, but a significant number, who recognize Palestinian rights, who recognize, if you like, the subjugation and justice experienced by Palestinian Arabs, and who recognize the path forward towards a mutually prosperous common future between the two rests on the recognition of rights, rests on human rights. And that's what gives me hope, because I see Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs who work on human rights and imposing the occupation as speaking the same human rights language, as recognizing the need for a common future. And I see them as the bridge towards a prosperous future of peace, justice, and durable stability.
Michael Link, I really appreciate your time, and I also your cautious optimism about the future for the Middle East and, I guess, you know, worldwide. Thank you so much for appearing on the program.
Michael, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Michael Link is Emeritus Professor at the Faculty of Law, Western University in London, Ontario, and the former Special Rapporteur for the Human Rights Situation in the Palestinian Territories.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
With the genocidal actions of Israel against Palestinians, we have arrived at a major crossroads in world history. So saith Michel Chossudovsky. One of the points he raises, however, is that the U.S. is not only refusing to stand up to Israel, the genocidal war is fully supported by the U.S. It isn't. The U.S. is not following Israel. It's the other way around. We will delve into this subject and the consequences down the pipe for Lebanon and Iran and more. Of course, Michel Chossudovsky is an award-winning author, a professor of economics, emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He's also the editor of Global Research, which in full transparency funds this show. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, Professor Chossudovsky.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's good to be with you. And I must say that what is lacking in the understanding of the peace movement, of the solidarity movement with Palestine, is the fact that Israel is a de facto member of NATO, and every single action that it takes goes through the command structures of the United States. The Pentagon, it goes to Central Command Headquarters for the Middle East, and it also goes up to Nebraska, to U.S. Strategic Command. So there may be flexibilities there, but when they go and kill the head of Hezbollah, or when they bomb when they bomb Lebanon, it is all orchestrated, and it is on the drawing board of the Pentagon. That is absolutely clear. Any government or any group which supports the Israeli government in genocide is under Articles 3 and 4 of the Genocide Protocol, Geneva Convention. It's complicit. It's Article 3 and Article 4. And I suggest that people read these articles. They're very easy. It's very straightforward. He said, if you are supporting the genocide in any particular way, whether it's through weapons or even promotion or media coverage, you are complicit, and the media is complicit. Okay.
So it's not just the United States that's complicit. You got France, Germany, Canada, and even the Canadian media that are providing a cover for this operation of genocide.
Well, absolutely, but they're mostly members of NATO. They're member states of NATO, and member states of NATO and member states of the European Union coincide more or less. These are all allies of the United States, okay? Mm-hmm. Even though they're also victims of US-led economic warfare. But that's not another matter. But the thing is there, it is important that our peace movement, first of all, understand that this, first of all, is not simply an action against Palestine. It's an action against the entire region. And all the actions against Lebanon and Iran and Syria and so on are indicate that the United States and NATO members are complicit in genocide.
Professor Chossudovsky, so you basically say that the United States is essentially using Israel to carry out, I guess, geopolitical maneuvers in their favor. It's kind of like the way the Ukraine government is kind of a proxy in the war, NATO-orchestrated war in Russia, or for that matter, the ISIS and Al-Qaeda, as you've argued, that they are being used to orchestrate efforts, again, in U.S. interests. Are the interests around the world different? Depending on the different orientation?
Well, first of all, I should mention the war against Iran has been on the drawing board of the Pentagon since 1979. And that coincides with the arrival of Ayatollah Khomeini, which was actually, it was a CIA operation that he comes back to his homeland, to Iran, and he's welcomed. And his function was there. It was a CIA op, was to destabilize the civilian and secular government, which had displaced the Shah Pahlavi. But I don't want to get into the complexities, but what happened, if I give a chronology, and that's very important, as of 1983, the United States launched something which is diabolical. It had official relations with Iraq saying, if you fight against Iran, we will fund your weapons, okay? They were giving weapons to Iraq in the same way as they're giving weapons to Israel today to go and fight against Iran, okay? Now, in turn, you had another component in that they were also covertly, and it was a CIA op, they were also covertly supporting the Islamic Republic of Iran in weaponry against Iraq, okay? So they take these two countries and they trigger warfare. And that is where some people will remember Oliver North and the Contras, okay? Right. Oliver North and the Contras, well, what it was there was some kind of money laundering process there, but it was essentially an operation which consisted in selling weapons to Iran undercover, and Iran would be paying for these weapons. And with the money, then they would support the Contras rebels in Nicaragua, which were there fighting against the government, which was, it was an elected government by the Sandinista movement, coalition government, and they were fighting against that government with a view to toppling it, in other words, destroying it. I was actually in Nicaragua in 1984 at the height of this.
Wow.
And then you had John Negroponte was at the embassy. John Negroponte was behind this, and he was at the embassy in Honduras, mm-hmm. with the role to support the Contras. They never wanted to have a leftist government in Nicaragua, so that was it, and so that Oliver North was there in a project which was funding, which was in a sense pushing weapons towards Iran so that they can fight Iraq. Iraq was receiving weapons also from the United States, and they were fighting one another, and the objective was there to destroy both countries, okay?
Mm. Now,
that's really very important because it just shows how diabolical U.S. military doctrine is, that they would take two of their, well, one was an ally and one was an enemy, and then they fund the enemy and they fund the ally. And the objective was, it failed, mind you, and there was some normalization between the two countries. But bear in mind, if you go fast forward, the Iran-Iraq war from about 1982 to 86, and then after that, one date which is very important, which I mentioned in my writings, is 1995. Central Command Headquarters, in consultation with Strategic Command Headquarters in Nebraska, they put together a statement. I'll read you this. This is U.S. Central Command, okay? He said, the NSS directs implementation of a strategy of dual containment of the rogue states of Iraq and Iran. As long as those states pose a threat to US interests, etc. Now, they don't pose any threat to the United States. The United States is thousands of miles away. And then they say that this is a process of dual containment, which is designed to maintain the balance of power in the region. But what is very important there is that, and I quote, the purpose of U.S. engagement, as espoused by the NSS, is to protect the United States' vital interests in the region, uninterrupted, secure U.S. allied access to Gulf oil. So this is this has always been a war for oil and gas, always, and it is today as well.
The gas there seems to be at least one major aspect to this genocidal campaign.
Well, absolutely. I've itemized in my article the following, pretty much under the heading United States Vital Interest in the Region, Uninterrupted Secure Allied Access to Gulf Oil. Today would be Gulf Oil and Gas. That is, in fact, America's promised land. It's not Israel's promised land. What do we have? Iran, third largest reserves of oil worldwide, okay? After Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. After Russia, Iran is the second country in terms of natural gas reserves, together with Qatar, and it has a partnership with Qatar, so that in fact you look at Russia, Iran, and Qatar, all together they have something of the order of 54% of the world's reserves of natural gas, which is approximately 10 times those of the United States. Now, you might say, well, let's assume that I'm some kind of phony climate CO2, I say, well, what we should be doing is to be closing down those countries so that it doesn't trigger global warming, okay?
Yeah. That would
say, why on earth would they be going after Iran and Russia? What we have to do is to close them down so that they don't produce oil anymore. Mm-hmm. But that's not, you can see that oil is, all the wars for oil and gas are there, despite the CO2.
When you're looking at the situation now, I mean, it seems as if NATO, that United States dominates NATO, and people who are members of NATO, they are actually serving the United States. I mean, they're almost, you know, they're under essentially the exploitation of the United States.
Well, absolutely. Let me just answer the question that you put forth just about Gaza. There is another oil, gas objective, and that is the coastline of Gaza, and starting in Egypt and going right up to northern Syria, which is a corridor of maritime natural gas reserves. I put that as number three, taking control of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, maritime gas corridor. Now, with regard to what you said, the NATO does not have any kind of decision-making procedures, even even in terms of command structures. It all goes through the very complex decision-making of U.S. Military and intelligence, okay, and propaganda, obviously. I'd like to quote the distinguished Vice President Dick Cheney, who pointed out, and that was in 2005, it was in the second term of the Bush administration, and of course they were still at war, you know, they were still at war. It was in the wake of the of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And Vice President Dick Cheney said, I'm paraphrasing, Israel will do the dirty work for us. Now, he wasn't joking there. And now I'll quote exactly what he said. The Israelis might decide to act first and let the rest of the world worry about cleaning up the diplomatic mess. And then you had the media headlines. This was, I think, the Washington Post that said, Bush should not push Israel to do dirty work in Iran. Okay. Now, what this dirty work concept signifies, it really signifies that all America's allies are potentially involved in dirty work. You have Germany who's sending weapons to Ukraine. You've got France sending soldiers to Romania, and then you've got all of these are also sending weapons to Israel. Although it pretty obvious that in the war against Palestine, most of these weapons are dysfunctional because then they're not there to fight a resistance movement, which is essentially working with Kalashnikovs and small arms and so on. Okay, so the fourth power in the world is military power is categorized as being Israel, but in fact it's an extension of the U.S. military apparatus, which is sitting in the Middle East. Dick Cheney mentioned that for Israel, but in fact, I would say that all the member states are doing the dirty work on behalf of America's hegemonic agenda. And of course, it's the powerful interest groups which are behind this war. It's also the fact that it's ultimately the financial establishment and so on, which are calling the shots. But at the same time, these allies are also the target and the victims of U.S.-sponsored warfare or economic warfare, right?
Yeah. Well, what would you say is basically the end game for with all of these, the shady dealings? You mentioned Oliver North, all of the tactics of using Israel and other people doing their dirty work. What exactly is their end game? Is it basically, to take over the entire Earth? Kind of like Hitler, only with more of a nice kind of public relations or something like that.
Well, I think there is certainly this, there's a hegemonic agenda, which is a unipolar world. Mm-hmm. And it is also, it's not totally independent from other components, such as the COVID-19 crisis, as well as the vaccine. The COVID-19 crisis was the lockdown was imposed on 190 countries from one day to the next with instructions to close down the economy. And that we know that if you confine the labor force and you freeze the workplace, which was part of the instructions, not to say that they were all applied, but this is economic warfare. And then we have the whole debate on the vaccine, that people who are taking the vaccine, well, that the levels of, we have ample evidence to that effect that the vaccine is deadly and is resulting in an upward trend in mortality. But the tendency here is to create some form of a dichotomy in one's understanding of the New World Order. Theater wars are not considered comparable to economic warfare, but economic warfare is what is being applied now to most countries in Western Europe. the hikes in fuel prices. They're not allowing us. They're not allowing the Europeans to buy oil from oil and gas from Russia or from Iran. Okay, so yeah. Inevitably this leads to hikes in market prices, collapse in purchasing power, and then there's the usual, I would say, the usual neoliberal agenda, which is applied now extensively in Western Europe. It's a third worldization process. And I would say that all these allies are, in a sense, they are also targets, they're enemies. Because if you're in a unipolar world, there's only one power. Well, it's complex, but let's say now, just to give people an example, Canadians in particular, is the United Kingdom an ally of the United States? The answer is no.
So,
no, it's not. And the reason is the following, and very few people in Canada know this, that in starting in 1921, the US government put together a plan to invade Canada. It's all documented. And who was leading this military agenda to invade Canada, to occupy Canada? It was also considered a territory of the British Empire, but in 1921 they had this thing. It was very serious. They even had biological weapons, which were envisaged. Several cities in Canada were envisaged for bombing, including Vancouver, Halifax, and Quebec City, and mainly port areas. At that time, it was very important. And General MacArthur was there coordinating it. General MacArthur then was, it was a bit like a dress rehearsal. They didn't really do it, but they threatened Canada. It's all on record.
Given the stakes, especially this critical juncture in history, what do you expect our listeners do to stop the course, especially with the election underway? And
I'm going to add one extra sentence to the, what I've just mentioned about that. In 1939, the war against the British Empire and against Canada was shelved. And then the United Kingdom and Canada were invited to participate in the Manhattan Project. So it went from an enemy to a friend. Yeah. And that is been the strategy of the United States. You threaten your allies, and then you also incorporate your allies when it's, that was of course the development of the nuclear bomb and so on. Now your question is of course very important. We should conclude on that. I think, first of all, we have to understand that we're at a very dangerous crossroads in our history. I haven't tackled the issue of nuclear war. It certainly is an issue. And if it happens, it will not be in Eastern Europe. It will be in the Middle East. And it would be targeting Iran. But I think at this stage, I think this is all very unlikely. First of all, because the Russians have an alliance with Iran, and I assume that they also have very high tech air defense systems. I don't think that this is going to take place, but it's still there. And if it does take place, it would be with the B-61-12. It's a tactical nuclear weapon. And what is very dangerous is that in the nuclear manuals, they say that the B-61 tactical nuclear weapon, which is a mini nuke, which has explosive capacity between one-third and 12 times the Hiroshima bomb, is safe for civilians. Now, they say it's safe for civilians, and it is actually permitted to be used in the conventional war theater. So it's not the commander-in-chief that decides, it's the military itself that decides. Okay. And I think that politicians don't really understand that any kind of nuclear war, even a one-third Hiroshima bomb, would potentially lead to the unspoken, which is the end of humanity as we know it. Yeah. I mean, this is something which we should spend, of course, much more time. I've written two books on nuclear war, and I'm very familiar with all the jargon, but with the decision making process, it's very complex. But the potential for making mistakes and also using artificial intelligence is there.
Yeah.
So I think that what is to confirm, we should stop accusing Israel, not completely, but we should stop accusing Israel, and we should say, you are calling the shots. The United States, Biden, is calling the shots. Well, maybe not him, but the Pentagon, certainly, the CIA, certainly. And you are responsible for the genocide, and you are complicit in the genocide, and we don't recognize you as a head of state. And we can't be asking the criminals to act in this regard. So I think that that's very important. They should, we can see what's happening with the courts of justice. And then of course there's the whole issue of the false flag. And the fact that that Hamas is categorized as a terrorist organization, when in fact we know that all these terrorist, so-called terrorist organizations, are CIA creations, Osama bin Laden et al.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very complex. It requires it requires that people start questioning the statements that they're making, and they should, the anti-war movement cannot be funded by Wall Street, okay?
Yeah.
By let's say Bill Gates or Soros or whoever, okay? Yeah. That's very important as well.
I thank you for being willing to talk to us. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Professor Chostovsky is an award-winning author, a professor emeritus of economics at the University of Ottawa, and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization.
You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation in the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.